This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are at episode number 14. And Happy New Year, everybody. This is the first episode of the new year, 2016. And I'm excited for what the year may bring to the podcast, I'm sure, or I'm planning to hopefully have a lot of great guests this year, a lot of great conversations, a lot of different ideas, a lot of different intersections. So you can help with that too. If you feel like somebody's doing some interesting work or at these kinds of intersections of family therapy, technology, philosophy, et cetera, and would like to know more or think I would be, you know, make an interesting guest on The Radical Therapist, please don't hesitate to email me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Would love your feedback and suggestions. So today's episode, we're going to be talking to Larry Zucker, a longtime narrative therapist based in Los Angeles, about escaping blame in couples therapy. But before we get there, I have a couple of quick announcements. For those that don't know, I actually direct a nonprofit in Orange County, California. If you're listening in the Southern California area, I direct the California Family Institute, which is a low-cost, even no-cost community counseling practice based in Costa Mesa, California, Orange County, California. So if you know of anybody that's looking for individual couple family therapy at a low cost or even no cost, nobody's turned away no matter what they can afford, please think about the California Family Institute. We also have trainings every month in narrative therapy. So if you're interested in participating in some of that, please don't hesitate to contact me. And I'll have all my contact information at the end of the show. And you can do that too. Also, another announcement, the Los Angeles POMO Therapy, Postmodern Therapy Gathering, has a new date. We are doing another gathering, and the last one was so successful and such a great time. We're going to be doing another one, Kathy Adams has scheduled a new date for the Los Angeles POMO Therapy Gathering, and that will be on April 3rd. So if you want more information about that, go to the Facebook page, I think is probably the best route. And that is, if you just search POMO, P-O-M-O therapists on Facebook, it'll come up. And then I'm sure all the news or whatever's happening next will come up there and you can get connected. And there's also a Google group, as well, LA POMO, Google group. So, look out for that. But anyway, and finally, I still have, Radical Therapist stickers. If you'd like some stickers for the podcast, please don't hesitate to contact me and I would be happy to send those out to you. That's it for the news. It's a new year. Excited about the podcast coming up and all the guests we're going to have. And I hope you feel the same way, and I think we're really starting the new year with a great show. I've been trying to put this together for a while now, since last August when I saw Larry Zucker give his presentation on escaping blame in couples therapy at the last POMO gathering. And we finally coordinated our schedules. We made it happen, and I'm really excited about it. And I think you're going to find it a really great conversation about Larry's work and long-time work with couples and how he approaches working with couples. So a little bit about Larry. He's been working with individuals, couples, and families at Larchmont Associates in Los Angeles since 1992. He's been and was in private practice 10 years before that. He received his master's degree in social work from Boston University in 1982 and followed that up with 3 years of postgraduate training in couple and family therapy at the Cantor Family Institute in Boston. He trains family therapists, has trained family therapists for many years in both his clinic and in university settings, and he's currently a faculty at the Southern California Counseling Center and is adjunct faculty at Antioch University in Los Angeles. Larry is a clinical member of the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, AMFT, and he is also an AMFT-approved supervisor. And so without further ado, let's talk about escaping blame in couples therapy with Larry Zucker. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the Radical Therapist podcast.
Hi, Chris.
Good to have you on. I know that we have we've been trying to get this together for a little while, and at least in my mind, I've been thinking about trying to get you on this podcast since I saw you give a presentation at the Postmodern Therapy Gathering in August. You had done a presentation titled "Escaping Blame: Helping Couples Develop Accountability." And I was just really thought it was a nice piece of work, and I wanted to kind of share it with our listeners too. So, thank you for, and then we've tried to, over the last at least few months, we've been trying to make this happen. So we finally made it happen. So thank you for your flexibility.
You're welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. So, and I thought we would just kind of maybe start, you know, talking about, you know, maybe I guess my interest would be, how did you come into the practice? I know, I don't know if you identify as a narrative therapist or how you identify, but I know you are narratively influenced and informed. And I was just wondering how you came into the practice, and maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about your history and what you're up to.
Sure. I definitely think of myself as a narrative therapist, and I have so ever since I began studying narrative therapy when I first met Michael White in perhaps 1991, I'm guessing. My memory is poor. I've been practicing therapy for 32 years or so, and for the first dozen or so years of my life, I hadn't yet encountered any postmodern therapies in general, or narrative therapy in particular. And I found my way through various schools of therapy, none of which quite felt right to me. In the early days, I was trained psychodynamically because that's what my graduate school offered. And then working in a housing project, basically, I was in a housing project clinic in Massachusetts. And psychodynamic therapy seemed really unhelpful to the families that I was working with that were dealing with many, many stressors, including psychosocial stressors as well as psychological stressors, and it just seemed like a really thin way to be working with people, which led me into a whole lot of training in systemic therapies, which at the time were structural, strategic, etc., and again, not yet postmodern. Those ideas weren't around yet. And then I don't know if you've had this experience, but you spend years sort of trying to develop your work and your thinking and your ideas, and then at some point in time, something sort of you run into something, or something clicks into place, and you start to go, ah, this is how I think about things. This fits something in me that previous ideas, previous models have not caught.
And that happened for you when you met Michael White or discovered his work? Or
it happened the first time I saw his work.
Mm. What a great feeling.
It's a great feeling. And I don't think it's a feeling that's easy to come by. And I don't think it's a feeling that people have really early in their careers. I think in the beginning of our work, we cast around.
Right, right.
And we're exposed to lots of different ideas. And everything kind of works and nothing kind of works. This is not some argument about one therapy being better than another. For me, it's more about something that fits my own beliefs about people, my beliefs about the way change occurs, my values about how I want to be in relation to other people. A lot of what we'll probably talk about tonight has to do with treating people as authorities on their own experience and not trying to become that authority. And when I saw Michael's work and David's work, David Epstein, it's like, oh, there is a whole a set of ideas, there's a whole technology that already exists, a whole kind of questioning that already exists that really helps people focus on what they already know and understand about their own lives, and that helps therapists move away from what they're so certain they know about their clients' lives, about human nature, about psychology, about systemic functioning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And so then how did you continue to study or learn the practice? Did you find other people to do it with, or...
I went to every training I could find, you know, that was related to this work. I just, you know, traveled a bit, was grateful that a whole bunch of, in the early 90s, Jennifer Andrews and Dave Clark, two family therapists in Los Angeles, started bringing a lot of the postmodern therapists to town for some training. They brought Let's see, Michael came several times in Zuberg, and
Steve DeShazer.
Yeah. Steve DeShazer came several times. Tom Anderson from Norway, Reflecting Teamwork, drawing blanks. And Carl Tom from Calgary came. They brought all these wonderful people to town, and I just sat at their feet as much as I could, and I watched them work, and I asked them questions. And David Epstein also came to town. And I read and read and read and went over transcripts of their questions over and over and over again till I learned the language. It's a complicated language, just like any therapy is. And when you're first learning it, you're not very fluent. It's right. a little frustrating at first, but it felt right. And I just kept practicing.
And how do you sharpen the saw, so to speak, these days? What's your process now? Or I know you're still involved in community. I think in Larchmont, right, there's a pretty good community of...
Yeah, I'm in a group private practice with some, you know, reasonably like-minded people where we, you know, think about work in similar ways and, you know, share a lot of clinical and political values and, you know, present cases to each other and talk to each other and encourage each other. And I have several other close colleagues that I spend a lot of time talking about these ideas with, and I continue to read a lot and you know, try to figure out who's a couple steps ahead of me in some of the work that's currently exciting me.
Right.
And try to follow them around a little bit.
So what's your recommendation to, because I think you really kind of nailed it with this idea of it's really learning a new language in a lot of ways, and even at where we're at in the training that we do. You know, we hear that often, that it is kind of learning a new language and it's going to take some time. But what is your, I mean, recommendation or advice to the new therapist or that somebody that's kind of beginning to wade into this work? Is it to go out to as many trainings as possible, that kind of thing?
Well, I think different people learn differently. this is sort of embarrassing to admit, but when I'm watching videotapes or live work, it's very hard for me to stay awake. I sort of like, I've never gotten to the end of an art history class because, you know, someone puts up a slide projector and the lights go down and I go out.
Right.
It's something about the way my brain works. My own particular style, what's been most helpful to me really has been transcript work. Where if someone's been willing to transcribe, David Epstein does a lot of this, where a lot of his materials are transcribed so that you can read the questions he asks and you can read the answers that they conjure. And you can go into sessions with lists of questions, not that you're going to ask those questions because the circumstance might not present the opportunity to ask those questions, but it's not that different from, you know, using, you know, flashcards when I was trying to learn Spanish, you know, with the vocabulary words on them. Here's all these types of questions
right. That
are a little bit unusual, right? And so I would read them over and over and over again, and I would make pre-session notes to myself before working with a client about the kind of questions that I thought I might be called upon to ask. And, you know, they're very specific and very technical questions, and they're very well thought out. And, you know, when I first started, you know, working as a therapist, the kind of questions that I would ask would be things like, you know, how are you feeling this week? And it's like, oh, that's a fair question, but it's not going to generate a lot. If you think of each question as itself a bit of an intervention.
Right.
Then how are you feeling isn't a very good question. How does that make you feel is the question we always joke about. You know, it's like, that's, you know, no, it doesn't take much training to ask somebody how something makes them feel. And that question very, very rarely produces an answer that they hear themselves say where they go, wow, look what I just said.
Right. So do you do your own transcripts now? Or I know some of the trainees in our clinic are actually doing transcripts. I'm really happy about that.
Yeah, I try to encourage. I mean, again, people learn a difference. Some of my clients record sessions and bring in video or audio recordings. Some bring in transcripts. It sort of depends on how you best take in information.
Sure.
You know, my favorite probably is transcript.
So you don't like watching video? Is not your preferred?
I'm happy with video, but I'm so language focused myself that it's always the words that I'm wanting, and so
yeah.
You know, and other therapists are different. Some therapists are, you know, watching, you know, body language and facial expression. Not that these things aren't interesting to me, but especially when I'm trying to help somebody learn how to do this work, it really is the construction of the questions. The therapist's skill at positioning themselves as an interviewer of somebody else's skill and knowledge community resource, personal resource, intentions, values, beliefs. It's like my job, you know, one of the things that's interesting, if you think about what it means to ask a question, therapists think they're gathering information. I'm going to ask you questions till I understand your experience. It's like, that's not the purpose of a question. It's like, I'm going to ask you questions that make you reflect on your experience in ways that you wouldn't have reflected if I hadn't asked you that question. The purpose of asking you a question is for you to hear yourself answer it. Or in couples therapy, for your partner to hear you answer it.
Yeah, I like that.
Right.
Yeah.
So questions are meant to generate reflection, not answers. I'm not that concerned with the answers to the questions.
Yeah, I don't think that gets talked about a lot.
No, I think it's really misunderstood.
Yeah.
I drive the poor students in my clinic crazy because they work in a clinic that, I guess by necessity, you know, gives them an intake form that has a series of questions on it.
Sure.
And they go into that first session and they feel like their job is to fill out the form and answer those questions. And it's like, I almost, you know, it's like, don't you dare take out that form in the session.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like your job is to go in there and try to understand the nature of this person's dilemma and the nature of their hopes, their dreams, what they're trying to achieve, why they're there. And if you ask any questions, it's because you're trying to understand that. You're trying to understand their intentions and their experience of what's obscuring their intentions, their experience of what's blocking them from getting what they want.
That's great.
And you're just trying to understand that, right? You're not trying to document anything. You're not trying to diagnose anything.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to be smarter at the end of that session.
Yeah, I'm gonna actually have our trainees listen to this.
Okay.
I enjoyed that. Another question. So how did your work with couples begin to develop?
I don't know. I do a lot of couples work. It's probably the thing I'm most sort of, quote, known for.
Okay.
In particular, I think I started developing a reputation for being particularly good with high conflict couples. But what's interesting to me is that I really think that so-called high conflict couples have just been a really interesting training ground for me to think carefully about therapy more broadly. I think a lot of what we'll talk about tonight, that has, if we're organizing tonight's conversation around my Escaping Blame workshop,
right,
and helping couples develop accountability, I think it applies to any kind of conversations that I'm trying to be part of or trying to host. That there's something, conflictual couples make the difference between conflict and conversation more apparent. And conflictual couples force therapists to develop skills for sort of taking charge of how a conversation unfolds so that it unfolds in a helpful way.
Mm.
There's something about the nature of a charged conflict that just lays bare the dilemma of turning sort of problem-saturated conversation, problem-saturated practice, turning it into something that can be slowed down and stepped outside of and examined. And if you imagine any high-conflict couple that you've ever worked with, it seems as if their purpose is to stop you from doing that, right? So you really have to figure out how to sort of help them disentangle themselves from that intention, because it isn't really their intention. They're not wanting to stump you. They're not wanting to defeat the therapist.
Right.
They're
right.
Not wanting to have a recurring argument that blows them out of the therapist's office every time. But they're tangled up in something. That's partly why I use the word escape. They're tangled up in something that they can't escape without our help, that does not suit them and does not serve them and does not serve a function for them.
Hmm. Well, let's move into how you conceptualize at least the idea of escaping blame. Mm-hmm. Debate in couples work, and then accountability and conversation. So how do you conceptualize blame, accountability, debate, conversation, etc.?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. Let me pull back the camera one more step and say something first about the kind of invitation that I think a couple in conflict inadvertently presents to a therapist. You know, when a couple's really locked in what I call debate, which we'll define in a minute, it's their understanding, their idea of what coming to my office is. The couples therapy to them at this point in time, at the beginning, it's just a venue to contest their differences, right? They don't really necessarily have, they've either never had or they had and they've lost a way to treat their relationship well and to be in the relationship in a way that works for them, given whatever it is that they want the relationship to do. And instead, they're stuck with some kind of difference over what they think is the case. And they think couples therapy is a place to contest that difference. And David Epstein has a really brilliant article about this. I can give you the reference to it at the end, where he talks about the three typical ways in which people try to recruit therapists into these
contests.
Yeah, where these places where we adjudicate the difference that they think they're there to contest.
Right.
Right. And you know, this article goes over those stances which we get drawn into. One is he calls juridical. One he calls ecclesiastical or moral, or one he calls the politics of reality. And then he situates those as normal things that people do because of the world in which we've lived over the last, you know, 10 years or 100 years or five centuries, that the idea that we might be contesting the truth of something, you know, is played out in courtrooms every day. The idea that we might be contesting the goodness or badness of something is played out in sort of David's metaphor for this is the courtroom of the Inquisition. You know, that there was a time when that's what courts did, was decided who was good and who was bad and who would live and who would be burned at the stake.
Right.
Right. And then the court that we're most familiar with and most easily tangled up in, because we don't see it as clearly, is the courtroom of the psychiatric interview. So if you really boil these things down and pay attention to what it is that couples are asking us to judge, to weigh in on, the juridical is, you know, could you please take a side on which of us is right?
Yeah, right. Right.
The ecclesiastical is, could you please take a side on which of us is good and which of us is bad? And then the most complicated one, and the one that's most confusing to therapists, is could you please take a position on which of us is crazy? Right? That, you know, right. One of us is saner than the other. And from my perspective, what all of these people are caught up in is that they actually think there's some kind of objective reality to be contested. Right? And as a couples therapist and as a person in a couple, I'm just not that interested in the truth status of any one person's claim. I'm interested in their ability to get along with each other, to get out of their relationship what they want, to understand each other's experience subjectively. Right? And as long as they think the goal is to get the therapist to take a position on whose idea of goodness, truth, or sanity is more correct and more closer to objectively true,
right,
the therapist will not be able to do anything helpful. Nothing I think of as therapeutic can begin before that contest has been interrupted.
So, and this is your process of interrupting that.
And that's right. This is my process of interrupting that.
Yeah, yeah, because that's pretty powerful stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, and you don't interrupt it just by arguing with people about philosophy.
Exactly.
You know, you don't say to them, you know, excuse me, I'm not interested in your objective reality. I'm only interested in your intersubjective experience and how you share it. That doesn't stop people from fighting.
Yeah.
They just look at you like you're crazy and then go right back to their fight.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
which I might have tried that once or twice. I don't know.
As a client?
No, as a therapist.
Well, I've tried both as client and therapist.
Believe me. I'm, okay.
I've taken both these positions. And I hope it's clear that I don't think ill of high conflict couples for acting this way. This is a completely reasonable way to act.
No, I agree.
It's reasonable to think that a therapist might make such a judgment.
Sure.
It's reasonable to try to get the therapist to see it from your perspective. But, you know, it doesn't have to do with what helps a couple sort of reclaim or rebuild or build their relationship. Some of these relational practices that I'm calling debate or blame, they really do have to be interrupted, and they have to be replaced with something else that the couple might not remember how to do or know how to do in certain areas. I pulled the camera back, but pulling it forward again, you wanted me to define some terms.
Yeah, well, let's start with the blame and debate, and then, you know, maybe move into that accountability in the conversation, which I think is where you're headed, right?
Right. That's exactly where I'm headed.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I think of blame as something an individual can do. It's an individual act. It's a pronouncement where somebody sort of imposes, you know, a truth with a capital T as that stands in for, it's some explanation for a shared experience. I'm a guy in therapy with my partner, and I'm saying, the therapist is trying to understand what happens between us. And I basically say, it's because of this about her. It's like, we're actually having some really complicated shared experience, but I've decided for myself that I can say what it is that we're experiencing. I get to name it. So now, usually when you use the word blame, you think of finger pointing and somebody calling somebody a name,
right?
Saying,
right.
You're a horrible person. And all of that's blame. That's true. This is because of you. You suck. All that stuff is blame.
Right.
But for a therapist to understand how to intervene on this stuff, blame has to be spotted at its most simple and benign and almost unnoticeable levels. So it's blame isn't about egregious behavior. It's about an individual attempting to impose truth, attempting to impose causal explanation.
Okay.
This is because of that, right? And I say so. As opposed to, let's the two of us account for some shared experience.
Which kind of makes it, I don't know the word I'm looking for, but usually we think it's kind of something a little more charged than that in some ways. Blame.
Yeah, and what I'm actually wanting therapists to notice is that if you're going to spot blame, you have to spot it long before it's charged.
Okay, yeah.
Because if you can't interrupt it when it's, in its beginnings, you're going to have the people can't control those horses, the couple's, ranting at each other and the therapist is deer in the headlights and the blame has gotten ugly and the therapist needs to have interrupted it 20 minutes ago
when a truth case is being made, right?
When a truth case is being made by a person.
Yeah.
Right? And again, contrast that in your mind with the notion of accountability. A lot of times, postmodern therapists picture the word accountability with a hyphen in it, hyphen in the middle of the word, accountability.
Right.
The ability to account for a shared experience. So if blame is an individual practice, something a person can do, accountability is a relational accomplishment. It's when people arrive at an agreed upon description of a shared experience through conversation. Right? It can't be imposed. Accounts are arrived at. Right? And they're arrived at consensually by people who are making meaning of things together. And if you picture a conflictual conversation with a couple, it isn't a conversation, it's a debate.
Right.
It's people, trying to convince each other of the truth status of their positions. Or if you go with the positions that I was talking about, couples intuitively trying to recruit therapists into, they're trying to convince the therapist to take a position on the truth status of their positions. So when couples are in my office, tangled up in debate, what I tried, and again, it doesn't have to be egregious. It's like, I'm sitting back and I'm watching, I'm going, what's actually happening here? Are two people talking and listening to each other and arriving at shared accounts of things? Or are they taking turns uttering, are they taking monologic, their turns in a rotating monologue? Each person monologues at the other,
right,
about what they think of as the truth. Well, they each look at the therapist to see whose truth will be endorsed, like which of those things is happening. And, if you think about the notion of, causal explanations and objective truth and all of these things are of dubious value to a postmodern therapist, a couple is, when both members of the couple are convinced that they know what the truth is and their partner doesn't know, right? What you have is a debate between, two pseudoscientists, arguing over the nature of reality.
Right.
And, the therapist, if two pseudoscientists are in your office arguing over the nature of reality, what is one tempted to do? One is tempted to actually trump them and say, I'm either going to say that person A is right or person B is right, or I'm going to say they're both wrong. But either way, I'm getting drawn into the same dilemma. It's like, if I take a position on truth, either by saying one of them is right or one of them is wrong, or that they're both wrong and that I'm right. Mm-hmm. It's like, any way you frame that, I'm now part of debate. I'm not yet having a conversation where people are trying to understand each other. I've gotten, including me, I've gotten tangled up in debate. And if you listen carefully to my definition, I've gotten tangled up in blame. Let's say I'm with an arguing couple and he says it's X and she says it's Y. And I say, you're both wrong, it's Z. Right. Now, that's what most therapists do most of the time. Therapists tell couples what it is they're doing wrong. It's like, you guys are lacking communication skills, or, right. you know, the, I, you know, you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, or notice your pattern, or
yeah.
something to that effect, right?
Yeah, but if you buy my definition of blame, that's blame. If you see blame as an individual act, a pronouncement of a person imposing truth, the fact that it's the therapist imposing truth doesn't make it any less blaming. So I think one of the first skills that a therapist needs to learn is to go, oh, wait a second, it's not my job to rule on these things. I'm not concerned with truth. I'm concerned with relationship, how it's treated, how it develops, what augments it, what injures it.
That's
and
great. Yeah, that's
to
great.
To get tangled up in blame and debate is not, isn't good for a relationship. To be in conversation that pursues accountability is good for relationship, right? That includes the couple's relationship with each other and my relationship with each of them.
Yeah. So I mean, has this been a process of, have you been drawn into debate often in the past?
Often.
Yeah.
Often.
Yeah.
Often.
Yeah.
All the time. This is, you know, trying to learn how to stand outside of this has been the last decade's work for me. Right. And trying to distill ideas down, which was what we're doing right now. These sort of coming up with a really clear map of the difference between conversation and debate, the difference between blame and accountability.
I was just going to say, I mean, I know we got a little ways to go, but even just this piece that we just went over is such work, I think. And but powerful work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you move to conversation, or how have you found it? An ability to step away from the debate and then begin to kind of have conversations.
Well, let me say one other thing that's a bit meta to that first.
Sure.
Which has to do with if you interrupt something, you can't interrupt it with nothing. And if you can get a couple to stop debating in your office, and then they say, "There, okay, we've stopped. Now what?" It's not sufficient to say, "Well, I just wanted you to stop debating because I wasn't having a good time."
Okay. Right?
So what is it we're actually doing? We're trying to change the debate into what? Into conversations about what? And this is, again, where people, I think, if they're only thinking about blame as egregious and mean, and if they're only thinking about debate as escalated, and they're not recognizing the subtle distinctions here, this is where I think people sort of lose their way. They can't find their way out of the territory, debate or blame. See, think about it this way in terms of what the subject of the conversation is. When a couple comes into my office and they're locked in debate, each of them thinks the subject of the conversation is the other one's behavior, right? That's what they think is the subject of the conversation, right? And if I'm a more traditionally trained therapist, I might think that's true. And so, for instance, the kind of therapist who thinks about things psychodynamically and goes, you know, I've got a narcissistic, the classic combination of the narcissist and the borderline. Okay, so if that's the case, that therapist is still going to be thinking that the subject of the conversation is sort of what's wrong with each person. The couple that they're seeing, each of them thinks the subject of the conversation is what's wrong with the other person, and the therapist is thinking the subject of the conversation is what's wrong with each of them. I think our job is to change the subject of the conversation to relationship itself. The subject of the conversation isn't the selves. It's not the flawed self that each one thinks the other one is, or the flawed self that the therapist thinks both of them are. The subject of the conversation should be relationship. So when I interrupt a debate where people are trying to convince each other that certain things are true about the world or about the other, I'm trying to replace it with a conversation that's really an exploration of relationship itself, of what the couple wants out of a relationship, of what their experience of the relationship is or was. A lot of times when you can interrupt debate, especially with a couple who's been together for a while, one of the things you find, and I credit Stephen Madigan with this piece, I think he's been doing really brilliant work about this recently, is that you find a lot of grief over the relationship having had abilities that have slipped away. The relationship used to offer something that it no longer offers, right? But the conversation needs to be about relationship, about its ways and means, about its hopes and dreams, about its practices, about its difficulties. So in the very beginning, and this, now I'm circling back to how I start to interrupt debate.
Yes.
In the very beginning, the subject of the conversation is debate itself, right? In the debate, the couple thinks the subject of the conversation is the flawed other. I think it's debate itself. So I start consulting them about how their debate works and what its effects are. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
First of all of this starts with various forms of negotiating permission with people to interrupt their process.
Yes. And you do ask for that permission, right?
I ask for that permission like 1,000 times.
Okay.
And I refer back to it 1,000 times.
Okay. Because you probably need to, I imagine.
Because I need to, because debate overtakes our conversation all the time.
Right.
So, you know, in the very beginning, they come in just, you know, going at each other. And I listen for a few minutes till I get the flavor of it. And then, you know, I say to them, you know, after a certain number of minutes, you know, do you need to let this, do you need me to see more? Do you need to let this go on? Or would it be all right with you if I interrupted this in the hopes that we can find, you know, get to the bottom of what's going on with your folks, you know, get to some better understanding of what's happening here. Because, you know, what you're doing right now, I imagine you can do at home. You know, you're probably, I'm probably getting a glimpse of what it's like at home. Is that true? Do you guys want to spend this time in here with me doing something that's not at all different from what you could do at home? Oh, you don't? You want me to help you change what you do at home? Well, then would it be all right if from time to time, perhaps even frequently, with your permission, I interrupt what you're tangled up in?
Yeah, nice. Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I ask for that, and I usually get it because people do want help interrupting it. They get that. Right? They don't easily stop it because each person feels that, you know, I don't yet understand the truth status of their position.
Right.
And that they're part
There it is again. Right.
Yeah, there it is again. It comes back again. So I say, you know that permission I got from you 10 minutes ago, is it all right if I invoke it again right now? Right. And so I get that permission and I kind of hold them to it as best I can. And with that permission, I start, and then I try to explain that because I'm set on helping them interrupt something that has sort of a life of its own, you know, I tell them, you know, I'm going to probably ask you some questions that are a little bit hard at first, that they're a little bit unusual and they're not how you're used to talking about your life and they're not how you're used to talking to each other. But are you guys willing to, you know, entertain some perhaps unusual or a little bit hard to answer questions? And that's sort of an extension of the permission. So it's like, yes, you'll let me thank you. You'll let me interrupt this debate that you're tangled up in. And thank you, you'll let me ask some really interesting questions that you're not used to about the thing that you're tangled up in. And then I start asking them about the debate itself. I ask them, you know, how they do it. And I ask them, you know, whether they like it or not. I ask them what they think it might be doing to them. I mean, a very, you know, early question I'm likely to ask a couple that's tangled up in debate is, so if I'm unable to interrupt this debate and this debate continues to take over your relationship, what do you think you have? What will your future be? Where will this go? Right? Is this debate taking you where you want to go? Right? And then if they say, no, it's not taking us where we want to go, I go, oh, good. So you're still on board with my helping you interrupt it. Right? Now, what gives you any hope that it could be interruptible? What if it's not doable? And that's my first foray into what I think of as sort of the, quote, good side of this conversation. The quote bad side is to help them teach me about how this problem operates in their family, in their life. It's the bad side because it's not the thing they want. It's the thing that's problematic. But the good side is what they're dreaming of, or what they had but lost and want back, right? Or what they have in other areas but can't figure how to have here. You know, when they're on vacations, they get along great, but when they're, you know, arguing over who has to put the kids to bed, they're having gigantic fights, right? So when I ask them, what gives you any hope that your whole life won't be eaten up by this debate, and they say, we get along great on vacations, it's like, oh, wow, that's great news to me.
Yeah, there's your opening, right?
There's a bit of an opening.
Yeah.
It's like, that suggests that debate isn't their total experience. It's something that's separate from them, but has been perhaps overtaking them so much so that they don't experience it as separate from them anymore. Right. And something that used to be part of their life doesn't feel like it's part of their life anymore, like getting along on vacation. So, you know, the metaphor and narrative therapy of externalization, the practice of debate itself starts to be externalized. We start to examine it for its effects.
Yeah.
We start to ask them to take positions on it.
Right.
And we start to put it in a social context. You know, what are the forces in your lives that actually encourage this debate? You know, do you have, you know, friends or family that are sponsors of either of your positions? Right? Do you have friends or family that think that debate is a good way to live? Right? Are there forces at play in our culture that support this debate? You know, and this is where it starts to become a little bit of a political conversation with people sometimes. You know, so if the two of you really disagree over what the truth is, you know, do you live in a world that says that, for instance, a woman should defer to what a man thinks is true? Or, and if that's so, is that world okay with you, with both of you, with each of you, right? So, you know, the you start to query people about the political context in which their debate is taking place.
I was going to say, so you'll make gender politics pretty visible in that process?
Yeah, but asking their positions on it.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Because otherwise, you know, I don't want to debate gender politics with them. It's like, you know, my wife and I don't want to live in a world where when people differ, men get to decide, but they might.
Right. Yeah, right.
Right. But I'm just trying to find that out.
Right.
Right. So, you know, if you both agree, and I've worked with some religious families, for instance, where they actually both do live in a world where, you know, the men are in charge of certain decisions and the women are in charge of other decisions. And it's not my job to subvert that.
Right. Right. Right.
It's my job to explore with them whether that, you know, in any way fuels debate. Or whether the opposite is true, whether that world would in fact support the dreamed of relationship that they have.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. So now the other side of the conversation, moving into what happens when you start finding those openings and that lead into kind of this move away from debate and into conversation.
Well, let me say something first about the deconstructive kind of side of this conversation.
Sure.
Which is, and this is something that when my students start to understand this, they start to really enjoy this, which is that even if a couple is embedded in really terrible relational practices, they're treating each other and the relationship really badly, if you can start to interview them as people who know something about what it is they're doing, they're incredibly knowledgeable about what it is that they're doing.
Yeah, right, and right.
One of my favorite ways for playing with that idea is to invite them into a fantasy. This what I call a perverse fantasy of imagining that the couple that I'm going to see after them is tired of getting along well and wants to be able to be engaged in the kind of sport that's taking place in my office right now.
Right.
Right. Right. So if this is my, I mean, pardon me if this sounds really crazy. I'm really sorry. I wouldn't do this without your permission, but would you be willing to tell me what I would have to tell that couple to do if they wanted to have the relational problem that you guys are embedded in? What would the practices be? You won't believe how smart people are about this.
No, I would imagine. Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah.
They start telling you, well, you should, you know, talk over each other for sure, right? And you should call each other names. And I go like, ugly names or, you know, really smart, like psychiatrically sophisticated names, yeah. Right? So, you know, you start, and the people, they know exactly what I mean when I say that. You know, it's like, oh, in our family, we never call each other those ugly names. We're way too civil for that, you know. But we each, you know, claim to understand each other's diagnoses and refer to each other by our diagnostic categories all the time. You are such a narcissist. It's like, oh, okay. So you would teach them to call names, and if they're really smart people, you would teach them to call each other sophisticated names. Okay, so they would talk over each other. They would call each other sophisticated names. What else would they do if they wanted to have your problem, all right? And so, you know, it's. This is not me diagnosing their problem. This is me teaching me how to have their problem, which they don't want.
Right, right.
And they know by now that I know they don't want it.
Yeah.
Like, you don't talk to people this way if you secretly think they want this.
Right, right.
Right. And narrative therapists never think that people secretly want their problems.
Right.
Problems are thought of as accidental in origin and loathsome to people and yes. Separate from them.
Right.
Right. So they are tangled up in some relational practices that they probably don't want. They can't find their way forward to something else. Turns out they're really smart about how that pattern operates. And if I treat them as experts on it, they'll teach me exactly how it operates and they will listen to themselves teaching me, right? They will hear themselves teaching me, right? So that's one of the major things that I do to help interrupt that, right? And then the article that I told you I'd give you at the end that David wrote also has a wonderful technical intervention for interrupting debate, which he calls cross-referential interviewing, where you ask people, and it's sort of a cousin of Carl Tom's internalized other interviewing, where you ask people to speak to what they imagine their partner's experience of a relational moment is, You know, so Jack and Jill are having an escalated fight, and you say to Jack, so when things really heat up between the two of you, Jack, what do you imagine Jill's experiencing as your voice gets louder and louder and louder?
Wow, yeah.
Right. And so, you know, instead of them fighting, Jack is actually pausing a minute to answer a question that's a little bit hard to answer. And Jill is not interrupting and talking over him because she's really eager to hear what he's about to say.
Right, right.
Right. He's about to say something that either will or won't come kind of close to what her subjective experience of that agitated moment is.
Hmm.
Right. And so and this starts to be another doorway into saying the subject matter here is relationship. You know, Jack, if I thought the subject matter was Jill, I'd ask you what you think about Jill. And Jill, I'd ask you what you think about Jack. But the subject matter is relationship. So what do you think happens at a moment in the relationship when such and such is happening? What do you think is happening in your partner when you guys are tangled up in an escalated moment of this? Right. So the cross-referential interviewing is another way to sort of interrupt that process. And again, it's another type of very hard question. You know, this might seem weird, but would you, instead of telling me what you think, tell me what you think Jill thinks. Instead of telling me what you feel, tell me what you think Jill feels.
Yeah. Wow.
Right. And it requires people to be in relationship and to attend to the relational experience in a way that interviewing people about their own experience doesn't, because it just invites more posturing.
Right. That's great. Right.
So the interviewing people about the practices of debate, the asking them to teach me how it's done, the asking them about its effects, the asking them to take positions on those effects. Is it all right with you that it does this to you? You know, you said to me before that if we were not able to interrupt this, it'll probably ruin your relationship. Are you willing to let this relationship be ruined by debate, or would you like to take this relationship back from debate? Is it important to you? Is this relationship still important to you? Oh, it is? Wow. And again, this starts to, you can see where I'm looking for the various doorways into the other side of this conversation, which is about what they want and what they dream of. So this relationship's still important to you despite 5 years of debating. Wow. What about this relationship has withstood that? Right? What about this relationship still matters enough to you that even 5 years of debating hasn't killed your hope that you could reclaim this relationship? Right? And you start to ask questions that I think of as the reauthoring rather than the deconstructing side of this dilemma. You start asking people questions about the relationship itself and about their dreams for it.
And then you move into... And is that where you kind of move into the relational intentions and kind of the values conversations about the relationship? And
yeah, and it's another variant of the permission I've already negotiated to ask hard questions. The place I want to go to open up the conversation about the dreamed of relationship is to talk about relational and what I think of as relational intentions. And my way of asking people about that is to ask them about what their relationship to do. They want their relationship to be for, right? Like why one would bother with the Sturm und Drang of building a relationship is because of what a relationship makes possible that one can't do on one's own.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Right. And when I warn them that the questions are going to be hard, we encounter a difficulty always at this moment. I ask them what they want the relationship to be for, and they start to tell me what they want the relationship to be like. And I kind of interrupt and say, I told you some of these questions would be kind of tricky. I'm not really asking you what you want it to be like. And then what I'm thinking to myself is, if I let you talk about what the relationship should be like, you're just a couple of beats away from talking about what your partner's behavior should be like and what they should actually be like as a person. And they're not, and you're mad, and you're disappointed, and all that. But that's not what I'm asking you. I'm asking you what this relationship will be for. What is this relationship? What do you want it to do for you that it's not doing now? Right? What do you want it to do for you that it used to do and doesn't do anymore? Or have your needs changed? Did this relationship, you know, do what you wanted it to do before, but now you want it to do things that it doesn't yet know how to do? I mean, when you guys first got together, what was your relationship for? Have your intentions changed? Does it need to serve other masters now? You know, and so you start to ask people about that. You ask them, what do you want this relationship to be for? How is that different than it might have been before? How is it different than it might have been in previous relationships they've been in? And then when you start playing with both the family historic and the sort of social and political, you can ask questions about relational intentions in that larger, deeper, older context. So what do you want your relationship to be for now? Is that different than what you want your relationship to be for when you were dating? Is that different than what you wanted your relationship with your high school girlfriend or boyfriend or partner to be when you were in high school? Is that different than your parents' relational intentions? Some of the intentions that you're sharing with me now, could your grandparents even have imagined such intentions, or did those intentions not exist in their time and place? I mean, if you think about a lot of current answers to these questions, for instance, a lot of couples speak in fairly egalitarian terms about, you know, sharing of responsibility and sharing of authority and mutuality. And it's like, I guarantee you that my grandparents did not have those intentions.
No.
Those intentions didn't exist two generations ago, right? Three generations ago, it was an arranged marriage. Two generations ago, the intentions had to do with economic survival.
Right, right.
And nobody had thought of things like, you know, dividing up domestic work and, you know, work and family in some even way that feels just to both people.
Yeah.
So that's a brand new set of ideas in the world.
Right, right.
And so you help people start to speak to their relational intentions, and you treat those intentions as really important and really complex and understandably hard to realize. Right? There's nothing wrong with being in a relationship that hasn't realized all of its intentions yet.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah,
it starts to orient the conversation towards the future that we're trying to build.
Yeah,
right. That none of us are in relationships that have realized all of our relational intentions.
Hmm.
We're all building relationships.
It almost then provides that sense of agency as well, I would think.
And say more.
Like just that there's still work to be done, and it can be done, and we can work toward it, and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, at a very common, there's certain stories that I guess reemerge, and maybe they reemerge because they're common, or maybe they reemerge because I like them and I'm looking for them. I don't even know for sure, but a really common experience that I have is that you start to tease out relational intentions that people have that were not part of their lived experience in their growing up. They're actually sort of creating a new branch on a family tree. They're trying to do something that hasn't been done before.
Right.
People start to experience themselves as pioneers in that regard. It's like people come into a therapist's office, and as soon as they realize they're not going to be told which of them is right and which of them is wrong, they're pretty sure the next thing's going to be happening is that they're going to be told they suck at communicating.
Yeah.
Right. They're going to be pathologized as a couple.
Right.
And when people instead start to have this really respected experience of like, wow, you guys are trying to, I mean, a minute ago, you guys were each talking to me about wanting the relationship to be sort of a platform for each person to sort of become sort of their best self.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did either of your parents have that kind of intention for their marriage? Was their marriage meant to enable that for each of its members? No, it wasn't. Wow. Where'd you get the idea that you would even want that?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Right. And you want something that no one's yet taught you how to do. You know that some people have done it, or might you guys be the first people on earth to do it? No, we know people have done it. Okay, so there's this thing that your parents weren't able to do that you know some other people have done, and you're going there. Right. That, I mean, would it be fair to call you guys pioneers?
Yeah, I like that word. I mean,
you know, the people that went from the East Coast to California in 1820, they knew California was there, and they knew some people had gone before, but their parents hadn't gone.
Mm.
You know, they went somewhere really new and scary because they really wanted to go. And so, you know, if you start to treat people as the pioneers that they might in fact be, who are on their way to something they really want, and they're in my office to try to figure out how to put that dream into practice through relational practices, then you start to be able to detail those practices. So to get to this dream that you have of being a relationship where the marriage supports each member's dream of becoming more fully themselves, do you think you should keep talking over each other?
Right.
Or is that a practice you might want to leave behind? What would you substitute it with? If you stopped talking over each other, how would you talk differently? What kind of talking do you think might help realize the dream that you just shared with me? And again, we're not teaching communication skills. We're asking them. In all of these ways of orienting yourself to the client, they're an expert on the problem. They're an expert on the problem's operations. They're an expert on the people and the cultural context and the discourses that support the problem. And they're also an expert on the dream. They know what they want. They know why they want it. They have some ideas about how to get to it. I probably have some ideas too, but I'm not there to teach. I'm there to tease out. I'm there to help them do their best thinking about how to treat the relationship. Stephen Madigan is doing a beautiful piece of work where he asks people, I think he'll do this as early as after a first session. I'm not sure about that, but I think so. He'll ask a couple to each separately and privately write a letter from the relationship.
Yes, right.
Have you seen that?
Yeah,
really beautiful. So they come back the next week and they write a letter that says, you know, dear Jack and Jill, you know, signed, you know, respectfully, your relationship. And Madigan asks them to sort of detail from the relationship's perspective, you know, what's the relationship feeling like these days? You know, what's it, you know, what's it liking and not liking about itself right now? What's it missing about things that it's had in the past that it no longer has? What's it dreaming of in the future? Why it still has some hope that the people could move forward towards the kind of relationship the relationship wants. So, and again, you know, this is very much the subject has become the relationship. If a couple leaves after a first session, if they come into a first session trying to convince me that the other one's, you know, wrong or bad or mad, right? And if they leave willing to write a letter from the relationship about what the relationship might want from its future and how it thinks it's doing so far, if we've gotten that done in one session, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Right. Now, that doesn't usually happen. Interrupting the debate is usually hard work. Sometimes it takes weeks and weeks and weeks, and I get a minute or two or three of separateness from that practice, and then it overtakes the session again. As you alluded to before, sometimes I just completely lose my way and get into giant power struggles with people where I'm just debating them. Right.
Well,
and you know, I just have to stop myself.
Yeah, if it makes you feel better, it was happy for me to hear that, actually. So, And I think it's going to be happy for a lot of other people listening to hear that, too.
You know,
sometimes we lose our way, too, or what have you. Yeah.
Well, if I'm really honest about my own work, I don't get too snagged up in escalated debate myself very often. I'm really good at not taking positions because I don't really care what people do with their futures. It's not my job to make their life go a certain way.
Right.
But here's what I do. When a couple's in the middle of something that I'm having trouble interrupting, I say to myself, by God, I am going to interrupt this next week. Because tonight, I'm really tired.
Yeah.
I don't have any steam left.
Yeah.
It just seems really virulent tonight. Maybe next week will be easier. And so I don't get as tangled up in it as I used to, but boy, do I become useless sometimes.
Yeah.
Right? And I just let it sweep over me. And then what's interesting is that's all that's happening to them as well. It's sweeping over them.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And they're just lacking the wherewithal to step outside of it. And they're lacking the practice knowledge.
Yeah.
Not without knowledge, but they're lacking the practice knowledge of what to substitute that debate with.
Yeah.
They might not know or remember how to talk to each other about their hopes and dreams. They probably did at some point, right?
Yeah.
Unless it was just some shotgun wedding where they're together by accident. And, you know, sometimes when you ask people about their relational intentions, you're actually helping them separate. You know, what comes out of the conversation is they want really different things out of a relationship.
Yeah, it'll happen.
Yeah, one person is looking for the relationship to provide a sense of security and stability, and the other person was hoping they would travel the world together, never have children, and have endless adventures.
Yeah.
It's like, oh boy.
Yep.
I guess one of the things that's happening here is we're discovering that there might be some really important reasons why you don't easily reach agreements on how to live your life. You might want different things.
Mm.
Right. And I actually consider that a good outcome.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
If the conversation produces, you know, a new account of why they're in trouble and what they might do next, that's what it's meant to do.
That's great. Okay. So, before I let you go, what's next for you, Larry? If people want to kind of see you talk about this work some more, do you have anything coming up, or when will you know?
Some of this is making its way into an online course in couples therapy that will exist on a website, which I invite people to explore, not just for this course, but for all sorts of wonderful resources that are there. It's called reauthoringteaching.com.
Oh, yeah. Peggy Sachs's.
Peggy Sachs's website out of Vermont. And it's a wonderful community of narrative therapists presenting all sorts of material to each other. It's gradually organizing into some classes that'll exist in archive form so that people can take them, you know, in the future as well as live. And this material will be showing up in the next 6 months on that website as a course that people can take.
That's great. Okay. And will you be doing anything in the next POMO gathering in Los Angeles? Do you know?
Maybe. Okay. Because I spoke last time, yeah. I'm sort of holding back a little bit, hoping that other voices will rise up and want to speak.
Yeah, I'm doing the same. So.
And I'm always willing to participate, but I'm wanting to make space for newer and younger voices. One of the things I love about the POMO gathering, I think it's incredibly inclusive and not overly privileging of the master therapist thing.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot of room for new voices, new thoughts, new ideas, and I get a little sick of myself.
Yeah, but some of us would like to see some more of this work. So
I get that.
Yeah. So how would listeners find you, or if they wanted to contact you and speak with you offline, how would they find you, or how would they get a hold of you?
Probably the best way to get a hold of me would be to email me at lmzucker@gmail.com.
Great. Okay. I appreciate that. Yeah. And after the fact, I'm going to hit you up for that reference for the Epstein article, because I want to put that in the show notes for our listeners.
Excellent.
So they can have that. And you don't have to worry about it now. I'll hit you up later.
Awesome. Great. I'll send it to you.
Yeah, Larry, I want to say thank you again. I know this took a little while to happen, but I'm really glad it happened. Very educational for me, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
I've enjoyed talking with you, Chris.
Thanks, Larry.
All right. Good night.
Well, that's our show. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. Please, you can find the link to Larry's website on the show notes at the radicaltherapist.com website. And also, we have, just so you know, the Radical Therapist Podcast has a Twitter site at The Rad Therapist. And we are on Instagram at The Radical Therapist. And we also are on Facebook. You can find us on Facebook as well at The Radical Therapist. And just search us out and like all our stuff. And please, if you could, take a moment to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us a lot if you could do that. If you like what we're doing here, if you don't like what we're doing here, go rate and review us anyway. I don't think it really matters as long as somebody's talking about us. So you can do that. And also I can be reached once again at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And if you have any suggestions for the show, we'd appreciate it, or any feedback. I love when I get emails talking about people's experiences of the show. Very much appreciated. So that's it. Happy New Year again. Welcome to 2016. I appreciate you listening to the show. And I think we got a great year ahead on the podcast. So please keep checking in. So my name is Chris Hoff. This has been the Radical Therapist Podcast. Thank you.